And when did you bring noise down?
In the early 60s. I was actually in the central administration by that time. I don't think I was chairman at that point, but I was involved with it. The major mover in that was George Watt, who was, I think, a counselor of the ACS and otherwise fairly deeply involved in chemical business, so to speak. And he's the one that ran across who would see noise and was instrumental in convincing. Noise was retiring at Rochester. Mm-hmm. I suspect the difference between 107 inches of snow and no snow impressed him in the winter. And he and his wife had a very pleasant 10 years in Austin. Matter of fact, they're buried there. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of interesting.
Oh. Okay. Well, that brings us to a point where you, as you just said, moved into central administration. You indicated earlier that when you became chairman, you realized, without any management background, that you liked doing it and that you found your skills in that. So what led to your moving up to the Dean of Research in 1961?
The chemistry department became notable on the campus for being managed well. The administration had fewer problems, no noise out of the place. We were sort of on the forefront of the movement, which was to become part of the world rather than be an ivory tower. We were ahead of Harvard and Yale, for example. Yale still hasn't got to it. But as I said earlier, I'm not sure it hasn't gone too far, but it was important that universities realize that they were not there for totally esoteric reasons. That you had to start thinking in terms of real people rather than fuzzy-cheeked boys and pretty girls and social events and whatnot, you know. Beauty queens, things of that sort. That universities were real and important things in the scheme of things. Chemistry led the way. Some of the others are still kicking and screaming, as a matter of fact. But the administration at that time was perceptive enough to recognize that this may be the way of the future, and so they tapped me for some other thing. That, in fact, the first thing I was tapped for was to fill in for the graduate dean, the dean of the graduate school, for 8 or 10 months while he went on leave. And I'm not even sure what date that was, to tell you the truth. But it was in that same region. I took that on along with the chairmanship. I didn't give up chairmanship. And I went over there and found out that you could do that work in 15 minutes a day. It was no great problem. The graduate dean never did forgive me for that. he was polite, but he was cool. That's where I began to look at structures outside of chemistry. Up to that point, I looked at my dean or the president or vice president. I went in the graduate dean's office for the 8 or 10 months, I can't remember how long it was, and recognized that the graduate dean was a horizontal blanket on a vertical system and therefore couldn't be very powerful. All these vertical arrangements went right to the president, and so he was flanked, just sure as hell. So all they could do was sign diplomas and theses and that kind of dissertations. Had no money. And that's still true, the graduate deans are not very powerful. If they have any effect, it's by dint of personality, not by dint of office. So I began to get a little understanding of greater management systems. By that time, the first fellow who had been asked to look at sponsored research, a man named Boner, C.P. Boner, physicist, had more of it than he wanted, and he went back to being director of the Defense Research Laboratory, with which I was involved also, by the way. That was a laboratory that stemmed out of the war. The Harvard Underwater Acoustic Laboratory. They did submarine signals, how to detect them and how to prevent giving the signals out. When the war was over, and he was up there as associate director, Walker, Eric Walker, who was president of Pennsylvania State, was the director of it. Boner was the associate director. When the war was over, the two of them determined that this work should continue. So an underwater sound laboratory appeared at Penn State, and one appeared at Texas, and a third one appeared at Washington. And I can't remember what that connection was. And that became the Defense Research Laboratory of the University of Texas, funded by the Navy, doing classified work, by the way, on the campus. Penn State had the same thing. Their building is right smack in the middle of their campus. I think the Washington one was at Friday Harbor, so it was off campus. And I became associated with DRL as a faculty appointment. And it was important to me because it gave me a chance to put some of my students to work over there. They paid for it. Hello. I did an ACS set of lectures last fall, and I keep getting calls from guys who come down to Texas from Maine. I was doing the Northeast up there. And I was kidding. He said, just call their temperatures 9 degrees in Orono.
I'm enjoying my week down here, too.
Let's see, where were, I was saying something.
We were talking about... you were talking about the Defense Research Lab.
Oh, yeah. That was a... We hadn't mentioned that. It started right after the war. And I joined it as a kind of a staff guy, probably 47, 48, 49 maybe. It offered me a place to put students that I couldn't support anyway, to do work that I was interested in. And I had, I think, three people who worked over there, got their degrees with me. And in fact, one of them was way off of what I'd been doing here. Hurd, Ray Hurd, did some work on, forget what he did his dissertation with me on. It may have been the iodine reaction, electrochemical iodine reaction.
List here.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about DRL. That was a fairly important part of my early time at Texas.
Those were the days when there was an objection to classified work going on campus.
No comment, actually. and I was a member of their staff probably until I became vice president when it would have been a conflict.
All right, here's the list I was looking for. Ray Hurd.
When did he get his degree? Say.
No.
It would be in the middle 50s.
He has some papers with his name on, published 51 in 56, 57, 55.
Mm-hmm.
Electrokinetic potentials of bulk
That's
metals.
It. Yeah. See, that was a little beyond what I'd been doing, but what we did over there, I guess it's no longer classified, was something called Solians, S-O-L-I-O-N-S. And the Solians were interesting little devices which came too late because transistors and other things like that. What they were little electrochemical cells with flexible sides and cast in polyethylene, I think. With wires inserted, you know, fused into. There was a platinum membrane with a hole. On this side was a Ki iodine solution of some concentration. On this side was a Ki solution with no iodine in it. This little hole permitted the movement of the concentrated solution through here. And when that concentrated solution came through, it had an electrical bias on it, the current went up. So you could read it. Now, what made it go through? Well, the flexible plastic membrane sitting in the water would pick up the signature of a submarine. The wave would come through, push this thing through, and it would do it in a certain fashion, so you actually got a signature by reading the current. And that's what they were doing. That was the classified work, among other things, we're doing other things too. And the question was, what do we know about that system? And one of the things we didn't know was the effect of the motion on that little hole. So Ray and I devised a dissertation topic which was very legitimate, and that is to determine the electrokinetic potential by electroosmotic flow of a platinum tube of about the same dimensions as hole. And it was great because those guys could pay for things like buying a piece of platinum and the instruments that we needed to make measurements and so on. And Ray Hurd was a fellow who had a truly green thumb in research. He could jump to a particular point without intermediate understanding in ways that were hard for most people to do. And that was one of them. He did a fine piece of work. And that electrokinetic, I forget where he published that, but it got a lot of attention.
Journal of Electrochemical Society.
Got a lot of attention at the time because it was one of the few papers in electrokinetics that had appeared for a long time. You know, way back there, they'd done some electroosmosis and whatnot. And it was just at the time when people were beginning to get interested in electroosmotic water recovery from seawater.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a good piece of work. At any rate, that's what DRL meant to me at the time. It gave me a chance to support some students. Well, at any rate, what I started to tell you was that Bohner, who had been the associate director of the Harvard Underwater Acoustics Laboratory, he had been a professor of physics at Austin, came back to Austin, became dean and vice president. He became first the director of an office of government-sponsored research. That may or may not have been its exact name. Or director of that. That's right. That's what he did. But he got tired of it and went back to DRL. this fledgling little office, which had two people in it, I think, was therefore unheaded by a faculty member, and that was not thinkable at the time. So I was asked by the then president, who was Logan Wilson, to head it. But then he had the perplexing problem, what do you do with a faculty member and a non-academic title? So they called me Dean of the Office of Government-Sponsored Research. And I had a man there by the name of Jens Jacobsen, who was the functional director, and I was the tie to the faculty. I did that for a couple of years, I think, and sort of got the thing established. The reason, and I suspect the reason that that was actually my first administrative job outside the department. The reason they did that was because I'd been the first to have a grant, and by the time I did that, I was 10 or 12 years old. And besides that, I never complained about other jobs. They didn't pay me anymore. Nothing happened except they gave me the title, and I ran the office. And I kept my chairmanship and so on. The next step, though, was different.
Mm-hmm. Were you... What was the principal function of this office? To find research opportunity or grant opportunities
No.
for faculty?
No, actually, it's the other way around. It was how to fit this outside perturbation signal into the system without discomforting the system.
Okay.
That's still a problem. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's a bigger problem now. Now the office itself is part of the, this is an opinion, not a fact. The office itself is part of the discomfiture. It has grown to the point where it's a canker in the system. it's not an expediter. It's not a thing that the faculty uses to make themselves feel comfortable. It dictates what the faculty has to do. Mm. That's what, there's something wrong with it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, when we started, principally what we did, my instructions to that little staff was, see what the faculty wants, see if we can do what they want with the money from outside, do your very best to not be bound too much by the rules that we already have. But if you can't do it, then just don't take the money. Now, that's unthinkable now. You don't not take money. So that office ran pretty well, mainly because Jacobson was a very able... he's dead now. Was a very able guy. Mm-hmm. Very understanding of the faculty. And their needs and desires, and did precisely what I told you. He'd try to make it fit, and if he couldn't, he'd tell all concerned, forget it.
Did this apply outside of the science engineering area, or was it...
At that time, there there was nothing outside. The reason I was a little hesitant, there may have been something in psychology. That probably started in the early 60s. They began to get some support. But it didn't apply to anything else, geography, anthropology. Anthropology may have... No, in those early days, anthropology didn't have anything. Social sciences were pretty much excluded. So the answer is it was predominantly science and engineering. And the engineers, who had very quietly consulted for years without ever telling anybody, and in fact using the equipment and the facilities weren't supposed to. They may not have known they weren't supposed to. They just used it. Mm-hmm. You know, they do water analyses and things of that sort. Charge $10 for it or something. The engineers didn't really get involved in grant operation, I think, till the middle 60s. I may be wrong about that, but I think that's right. The engineers are operative engineers, not quasi-scientists, as they many of them currently are. They got a little upset by the way the scientists were harvesting money and decided to do the same thing. You may remember that the National Science Foundation really didn't have much of an engineering division until late 70s. The engineers really jumped up and down, raised the devil, threatened to have a National Engineering Foundation and so on. The engineers really got their act together in the 70s. So I don't think they had a lot at first. So primarily chemistry, physics, astronomy, not math. You know, math up until the 80s didn't do a whole lot of this kind of stuff.
Computer science was still a fledgling group at that time.
Computer science was a fledgling group, yeah. I'll get to that because I had a big involvement.
Okay.
And astronomy, I had a big involvement. I became an ecumenical scientist when I got into administration.
Well, maybe that's what we should spend the rest of our time on this morning, because you were only in that position a short time when you moved into a much bigger administrative picture in 1961.
Yeah, that what happened in 61 was that Logan Wilson went off to be the president of the American Council on Education in Washington. Harry Ransom, who had been his vice president, became president. By the way, there was a big change already seated at the university. It had become a system without knowing it. The University of Texas, if you ask anybody in 1960, you didn't put at Austin, you just said University of Texas. In fact, I still do. But at that time, there was a, aside from that campus, there was a Galveston Medical School. I think it was called Texas School of Mines at El Paso. The McDonald Observatory out in West Texas. And a Marine Institute, wasn't called Marine Science Institute at the time, but Marine Institute down on Mustang Island. And I think that, a dental school in Houston. That was the University of Texas group. And the one in Austin was called Maine University. Literally, we referred to it as MU. So the president of the University of Texas had these branches, a few branches, three or four. And the vice president was the inside man charged with budget affairs on the main campus. The dean of the medical school, and he was a dean, not a president. Mm. At Galveston, there was a president at El Paso, so it's not a very uniform system. There was a director of the Marine Institute, but there was no director of the observatory. The director of the observatory was the University of Chicago guy. So the president had a vice president. Vice president had a bunch of deans and so on. including this peculiar dean of research. Logan Wilson left to become president of the American Council on Education, which was kind of a step up. And the regents picked Harry Ransom quickly. He, in turn, picked a fellow named Joe Smiley. Who had been Dean of the Humanities at Urbana, French professor, as his vice president. Well, very shortly after that, the decision was made by the regents that they had to look at the complex as a system. And they decided that there would be a chancellor of the system, and a president of the main university, and a vice president. Ransom was moved up to chancellor. Smiley was moved up to president. That left an opening. And they must have looked around and decided that I'd done all right with the department, with the graduate dean's job for whatever time it was. And the Office of Government-Sponsored Research was working, so they asked me if I would do it to the vice president. Now, I'd never given that any thought. I mean, the dean's thing I did, you know, while I was chairman. I thought being chairman of chemistry is as good as you ought to get or do. So I said I would do it if they would not keep me from A, teaching my classes, and B, doing my research. Now, they probably thought I was kidding because they said right away, sure. And so I took it on. And I started in September of 61, I guess. Joe Smiley is a very nice fellow with a good appreciation of what academics were. But he loved a good time, he loved good stories. He just didn't like writing budgets, that's all. And I had learned one of my first great lessons about administration. The budget writer runs the place. I wrote the budget. I came in September 1961 and started on the 1962-3 budget a month later. I had no experience. I didn't know what you do or anything. I had the advantage of a very fine business manager. He was not yet vice president for business, a fellow named Colvin, Jim Colvin. And he and I got along very well. He had come there about a year before that, in the first change when Smiley was vice president. And Jim and I got along very well, still do. And I'm sure he must have helped me over the budget writing process. I don't remember any details, but we got a budget out that first year. And in fact, I was running the university. Mm-hmm. Joe had a fine time. There were no problems between us. We really got along very well. But I learned that big lesson. If you write the budget and know what's in it, you sure as devil also know how to operate the place. And it turns out that Ransom didn't like writing budgets either, by the way. He was interested in library collections and archives. And if you didn't bother him in those three places, you sort of could do what you wanted. So in a sense, I had this whole shebang. Well,